Good evening, everybody. Chris Lee, Graham Doty, Alfred Esmond here to talk SEC baseball. We got one of the finalists in Omaha. Congratulations to the Tennessee Vols on their first appearance, I think, ever in the championship series. And most likely about to be joined by Texas A&M, which is up 5-0 in the sixth as we do this. I tell you that in case you catch this on the replay version later. That's where we are. So we're going to kind of make some assumptions about maybe an A&M-Tennessee matchup. We will not do the full preview on that. We'll probably do that tomorrow in a non-live video. Of course, you know what happened? We made assumptions last night, and I called it. I said I've just basically guaranteed Florida a win. So I thought Kentucky would win that game, give A&M a fit in the nightcap, and instead, no. Florida boat raced. Kentucky, and now A&M having its way with the Gators is the magic. Finally starts to run out a little bit, but looks like we are heading towards a collision course of Texas A&M and Tennessee in the finals, which arguably, I mean, there were several teams in that mix. I think Tennessee was everybody's consensus number one, and I think A&M was about as good as anybody left. Again, my pick to win the tournament before it started, so look, sometimes you get finals, no offense to anybody, where you get an off seed like an Ole Miss or Virginia making it as a three. And sometimes you get the heavyweights that were there all season all along. That's what we get. It's going to make for some great baseball. We got a lot of future major leaguers in this one. I think if you just want to see great baseball, the only complaint you will have with this final is that all the guys may be not there with the Montgomery injury, the Sadeo injury, and I guess Laviolette playing hobbled, but playing, which we didn't know that was the deal last night. So anyway, gentlemen, welcome to the show. Welcome our audience to the show. We're going to get right into it. But first, we got to pay some bills here. Reminder, our channel brought to you by BetOnline. Your number one source for all your summer sports this season, from MLB, golf, the NBA, and NHL playoff stats. All the latest stats, news, and scores available to follow your favorite teams. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest team matchups, player props, and odds on just about every sport out there. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Bet online, where the game starts. All right, full disclosure, I had a pop-up family emergency that took almost my entire day, which is always what happens when you're looking forward. You've cleared out your day to watch baseball. Of course, that was what was going to happen. But fortunately, I got these two guys with me, and I was watching game trackers and a little bit here and there. But I think you guys were pretty locked in. We had three games to discuss today. Graham, I'll throw it to you first before throwing it to Alfred. Where would you like to start on the events of today?
I guess let's just kind of go in chronological order. First game of the day, Florida, Kentucky. I think last night I picked Kentucky to win, and they scored first. They jumped out early, top of the first, and I'm sure they were feeling good. And then it was just a total avalanche in the bottom of the first. Florida puts up a 7 spot. They hit a grand slam in that bottom of the first inning. And after that moment, after the first, they were really in control. Like, Kentucky tried to make things interesting here or there, but never really got the feeling like, Florida is in danger here of losing this lead. So Gators absolutely just took care of business in game one. And from a broadcasting point of view, like, the first inning was 45 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sitting there as a broadcaster, just like, those games are tough because you sit there and you think, what in the world are we going to talk about, you know, moving forward here? And, but really after the first inning, it was pretty much cruise control. So Florida looked good in the first game of the day. I'm happy for Jack Caglione. Like, Matt LaPorta was in the house, and Jack breaks the record in game one today. Mm-hmm. And cool moment. Like, I saw the fan that caught the home run ball, gave it back to him after the game, and Jack signed gloves and gave it to him. So mm-hmm. I thought that was a very cool moment. So congratulations to Jack, like, one of the best players I mean, in recent history, you know, and all time in SEC history. So he definitely makes his mark in SEC history. And just like a lot of, you know, cool things in the first game. And then Florida State, Tennessee, like we were wondering what in the world is Florida State going to do as far as pitching wise. They kind of go with a wild card and they go with a true freshman that hasn't pitched in 17 days. And he goes a third of an inning. And Tennessee's just, I mean, once they get going, they're an avalanche and they're just so hard to stop. And Tennessee just did what they do and just handled business against a very, very good Florida State team. So Tennessee in the national championship game on the broadcast, they said they won the whole thing back in the 1950s. So it's been a minute for Tennessee to play for a national championship baseball wise.
Yeah, I guess I'll build off that too. Just because we have Florida on, I'll just talk about them for a second. That first game, we guessed correct with Pierce Coppola starting, and he did what he needed to. And it was probably, if you take the earned run count out of it for him, his best start we've seen from him yet to date as a Gator. 9 strikeouts in 5 innings of work, walked only 3 guys and faced 21 batters. So, you know, he did what he needed to do against this Kentucky team. Granted, the offense did help him a ton this game. And in that first inning, you know, it really helped him out with how they were able to score runs and whatnot. But Florida needed to be efficient with their pitching. That was kind of the name of the game. And they got out on a good note and didn't really need to be – well, they didn't need to be as concerned about it. And as you can see, they only used 3 pitchers today. They went with Clemente and then Philpott later in the game that ended out. But Kentucky, we were concerned. Chris, you in particular were concerned about Dominic Niemann and how he's played. And it kind of reared its ugly head today. He goes a third of an inning, giving up 5 earned runs. And the Gators got to Cam O'Brien, who came in next as well. I believe that's who Donae hit the grand slam off of. I could be wrong about that. But speaking of Donae, huge game from him. He had another home run that game as well. That guy has some power if once he shows it. It's major. And Florida's got to be proud. You know, regardless of the result right now, 5-0 in the top of the 7th, they got to be proud of kind of where they're at and what they did this tournament. It was a team no one expected them to be there to this point, and they're able to walk out of Omaha with a couple of wins and be one of the final 4 teams remaining this season, which is something to be very proud of for that team. It just shows the standard Kevin O'Sullivan's placed there for a couple decades now, and they'll continue to, I think they'll continue to be a threat this year. I've seen already some transfer portal pickups they've made. And I mean, they're going to be there years on end. And as for Tennessee, the Vols, like someone said in our chat and Graham said, first time they've been in the final since 1951. That was a while ago. And Tony Vitello has finally breaking through at least that kind of curtain to get to this point. And these past 2 games for Tennessee, minus the emotional one against Florida State, the first game they had, they've kind of been in control of these 2 games, and it's the spot they exactly wanted to be in. They were huge in kind of stopping some hot Florida State hitters. Cam Smith and Jaime Ferrer both went 0 for today, which I think is massive considering Ferrer had been on a tear in Omaha, and Cam Smith is borderline, if not All-American, of an All-American hitter. He's right there, and he's going to be a first-round draft pick. So big-time stuff from Tennessee today, and Xander Sechrist was great on the mound again. He's been their best starter as of late. Went 6 1/3. He gave up the 2 earned runs. Those were 2 back-to-back homers. And, you know, but besides that, before that, he completely shut down this lineup and just let Tennessee do their thing on offense. Struck out only 3, and that's not really his style, striking out batters. It's more force the ground balls with his breaking ball action. That's what he did a lot of today. And the other thing, too, I noticed about that Tennessee game, Tennessee's infield played phenomenal on defense. They had a good throwdown at home to keep Florida State off the board early. They had a few double plays in there that were just backbreaking for the Seminoles. And yeah, Tennessee's cruising into the final now for the first time in a long, long time. And they got to be feeling good because they're sitting back on the couch watching whoever they're going to play. And I think at this point, it's safe to assume, although there's a lot of people in our chat are going to say, oh, we knew this. It's safe to assume now, I think, that Tennessee can hit with anybody in the country, which is absolutely huge.
Speaking of that, I think one of the early plays today, I was watching on Stat Broadcast, did Burke start a double play to end like the 4th after FSU had a couple of guys on, was kind of threatening. I think I read that right. That was kind of a key moment, speaking to that infield defense.
Right. Yeah. He went to first, then threw back to second. And then I think they were just, I mean, it was, and even a lot of the pitchers came in relief, Cannell and Snead. They had plays where they got their hand on the ball, or at least their glove on the ball, to knock it down. And the infield, I know Christian Moore picked one up and threw a man out at first. I think that was when Cannell was out there. Snead had one too in that ninth where, you know, Florida State, obviously, I think that offense could have came back down 5 runs, which is what they were. And he had a big, I can't remember who the batter was, but it was a ball hit and it hit his glove, knocked his glove off, but it kept it in the infield. And that was really the only action Florida State saw that entire inning towards the end there. So they did a good job shutting it down. And a lot of it was their defense, which is something not necessarily of concern, but it's something that I don't think people point out a lot about Tennessee, but that was really on display today. And that was probably the thing I was most impressed with.
Yeah. And the other thing, like, we were wondering who would be in center field, and it ends up being Tears, and he just makes an insane catch pretty early in the game too. And Tony Vitello on the broadcast, I mean, he said it reminded him of that Ken Griffey Jr. catch. So phenomenal catch. Defense was good today for Tennessee, and the offense, I feel like they continue to break records. Like, they were the only team in NCAA history to have 4 players with 20 home runs or more. Now they have 5. Wow. So they broke their own record with 5 players with 20 home runs or more.
You gave a shout out to Matt LaPorta earlier. Good call. I don't know if you guys were around for Matt LaPorta. I was. Saw him. I actually covered him a little bit. I think that guy, he didn't do as much in the pros as I would have thought. I think he bounced around with the Indians a bit. I think maybe there were some knee issues. Matt LaPorta, I think, is a top 5 hitter in the SEC in the last 20 years. I mean, that list is probably, I don't know, Condon's on there. Dylan Cruz is on there.
Mm-hmm.
Caglione's on there. You could, I'm sure I forgot some guys, but I mean, White Langford. I mean, it's been a beauty patch, but I think for his time, remember, home runs weren't getting out quite like they are now.
Yeah.
And I think he
had forever.
Massive power, just massive. I mean, he was hitting balls further than anybody when they didn't go as far as they. And so a man in his time context, I mean, he was, Matt LaPorta was a machine. So that, and I think stars of the day, when this is an offensive heavy era, I think you look at 2 guys, first Xander Seacrest with Tennessee, a second Justin Lampkin. We kind of called him out as a guy who pitched better of late, but it hadn't been like, it wasn't great in maybe parts of April and May. Feels like he kind of got it together, whether it's Tanner Jones didn't. Alfred, I will start with you. And I know you touched on some of it earlier, but Xander Seacrest is outing today in a big, big spot. Like you said, people called him out. He's been their best pitcher lately. He really, really showed up and did Xander Seacrest things today.
Yeah, and speaking of him all year, I know Tony Vitello during the game, when the dugout reporter went up to him, he had a lot to say about Xander. And the biggest thing is, I think it's kind of a blessing in disguise for him and the rest of the Tennessee team. I never would wish this upon any player, of course. I'm sure y'all wouldn't either. It's kind of a blessing in disguise, the A.J. Russell injury happening, because that's kind of how Seacrest got into this rotation in the first place. And as of this NCAA tournament, they've all been solid, but he's been the one that stood out. And part of that is because he's the third and kind of closer game guy in the rotation. Like, if the World Series was to go to a Game 3, he would be the guy out there. And I think, you know, with him, and it's not necessarily just dominant double-digit strikeouts like you see from some of the top pitchers in this country. It's just really kind of, he absolutely manages the game, and he throws hitters so much off their timing and their rhythm by these breaking balls he has. And he has, you know, he has the weird sidearm action. I don't know if it's a submarine as much, but it's a sidearm action that kind of, it's wonky. I think that's a good word to describe it. It's very, very wonky. And it's a good way to throw off these batters. And Florida State had trouble leaving the infield. I know Marco Dinguez did a good job getting balls out into the outfield. He kind of got hosed on a few, you know, of his fly balls just because they were short of the track and whatnot today. But besides him, there really was, you know, I guess, you know, the two home runs in the end kind of, you know, make me retract a little. But at the same time, up until that point, there was really Florida State just kind of struggled to get hits. I mean, they were sitting at two hits, it seemed like, in the game for a long time. And yeah, I mean, it continues to be a big time season and tournament for him. It was something he needed because I think Tennessee anticipated him with Russell being healthy, just being a jumbo reliever out of the pen. But yeah, with these starts going forward, he can be a confident starter for Tennessee. And I mean, he's made a name for himself this tournament.
I think he was their midweek guy last year. Is my memory on that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And Russell, you're right. Russell came out looking like their best arm this year. I'm 99% sure I saw that they announced last week that he's having Tommy John, correct?
Yeah. He's been in the dugout with a sling, so he's done.
Yeah, he's done. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was pitching to contact. This is a park where you can get away with it, but we're still seeing balls flying out. And that's always scary facing that Florida State lineup. But you said, I think the key was just keeping guys off balance. That felt like a more, I don't know, and not that Tennessee had plenty of these, but the fielding, the pitching, those things. Like if you said Tennessee won a slugfest 12-8, that surprises nobody, right?
Right.
To see a team win in different ways. I don't know. I think if I'm a coach, I'm feeling a little bit better about that. Not that you felt bad about Tennessee, but you know right. what I mean? Right. Just showing that you can win, because when you think of Tennessee first, you think of the bats, not that they don't have good pitching, but to see them win one like that with the way the ball's been getting out to Omaha, I think Tony Vitello will sleep a little better tonight with that.
Yeah. Especially against a team, you know, especially after that emotional game they had with them to start the tournament and how that went. I mean, it was kind of not typical Tennessee win. I mean, they came back down 4 in the 9th, but it was sort of kind of the wins you normally would see out of them and whatnot. And at the pitching and defense showed today, assuming Texas A&M ends up winning this game, we're in the top of the 8th. Yes. The top of the 8th of that one, assuming Texas A&M wins Tennessee should feel very confident about the defense and pitching they provide, because, and that's going to be, there's going to be some good pitching matchups if that holds true. I mean, we're going to have Prager opening, assumingly, yeah. and then going up against Stamos and then Causey Sneed, that little combo, Drew Beam, the second game. It's going to be phenomenal baseball, just back and forth. And Tennessee showed that they have the defense. They can win this national title, in my opinion, with ease if they wanted to. Now, Texas A&M could provide a very big challenge, but they showed that they're, I think, the best team and the team to beat going forward with whoever ends up playing them out of Florida and A&M.
And then there was Justin Lampkin, who has struck out 9 guys tonight, 5 innings. He's done, walked 1, gave up 3 hits. Grandma, I'll let you take that one if you got to watch a lot of him tonight. But that's a thing, like, I think both coaches left. Well, I say left. We're presuming that A&M preserves a 5-run lead here. Both coaches will leave with some really good things under their belt today, and I think Lampkin's performance certainly tops the list for Jim Schlossnagel.
Yeah, no doubt. Really, all the broadcasts kind of, you know, they've all touched on it, but all the head coaches, the main focal point was we need our starter to get 15 outs, so 5 innings. Yeah. And that's exactly what Lampkin does tonight. 5 innings, just the 3 hits, struck out 9, only threw 70 pitches. So, like, his pitch count, he was in good shape through 54 strikes. So he was absolutely phenomenal in his start and really, really putting Texas A&M in a fantastic spot as they try to punch their ticket to take on Tennessee.
For those of us running a 10-year-old baseball practice tonight, what happened with Cortez's outing? Because he threw 8 pitches, walked 2 guys, got pulled. Was there an injury there?
No,
he just didn't have it.
All of his pitches were out of the zone. So walked the first 2 batters, and then Schlossnagel immediately, like, no conversation, like, just come out of the dugout, make a change, and just move on to Stewart. So Stewart, 2 innings in relief now. He hasn't given up a hit. He's got 4 strikeouts. So between Lampkin and Stewart, those two have been phenomenal tonight for A&M.
Well, and Josh Stewart has gotten more of the load as the season goes on. I mean, we said that bullpen, I think, was about as good as anybody's. And we'll unpack this a little bit more in our preview, but seeing them lean more on Stewart, and of course somebody was going to get some innings somewhere with the domino effect of Shane Sedeo being hurt. But I'm going to look up the number of innings coming tonight. I think he was in the low 20s, maybe. Where is he? Okay, you had 25 innings coming in, but he pitched pretty well of late. And so that's another thing that, like, looking at the stat sheet for Josh Stewart, throwing a little recency bias, and that arm's a little better than the numbers on paper look. Because his ERA was pushing 5 coming in, but that's a guy that they've really leaned on a lot late in some big spots.
Yeah, they have. In particular, Omaha, they've really leaned on him a lot. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Graham, because I think you caught this part more so than I did. Florida threatened in this game. And I think that was when Cortez was out there with runners on second and third. And obviously, you know, with this kind of, with what Florida showed earlier today and really what they've shown through this tournament, that was a tricky spot to be in. And Stewart's a guy they can use in leverage. And one would have to imagine, you know, once they eventually play Tennessee, assuming they win the game, that's going to be, you're going to face leverage opportunities a lot against that team. So he's a guy that could definitely go out there late in games if A&M needs to shut it down coming up this weekend. And he'll be a guy we lean on and we see this weekend. We could see him. I really kind of putting him in, we can see him at any point in time going forward, just because I don't know if you really have to push him a whole lot if he gets the job done, just because of how deep the bullpen is too for the Aggies in general.
Probably the biggest moment in that game tonight is Florida goes to Brandon Neely mid count. And we said, hey, you've gone this far. Sure, just screw pitch right. counts at this point. You know Neely's going to throw. And he's still in, by the way. They bring him in 2-0. I think he throws a fastball and off-speed pitch. And I think the third one, Caden Sorrell crushes into the outfield bleachers to make a 3-0 game, 5-0. That's when it felt like, you know, it was probably going to be out of the reach for Florida. But, I mean, here's the point. We've talked about how this lineup's got so many good guys in it. And Caden Sorrell's a guy that really hit well, I don't know, I'm going to say from mid-March or April on. And I know they're without Montgomery, who's in the dugout in street clothes, and Laviolette is playing tonight, playing in right. So that answers a big question. But they have got – I know it's not Tennessee's lineup, but they've really got some dudes who can hit. And I think he, you know, it was Caden Kent against Oregon, had the two biggest hits in their biggest inning of the year, that 9-run inning. That's another guy who started to make his presence known a little bit, guys.
Yeah, him and the other guy tonight, too, had a big time hit was Grahovic, who had RBI, yep. I think it was an RBI double to make it 3-0. And he has two hits tonight. And this has been a game, too. Currently 4 hits for the Aggies, 3 for the Gators, and A&M's been on the luckier end, and they've gotten 5 runs out of it just by having guys on base more so than Florida has, and that's been the biggest key. Honestly, up and down this lineup, we've talked about just, you know, how this lineup has picked up the slack, so to speak, for Montgomery, and I say that, but also they can just hold their own flat out as well. I said Caden Kent last night has been doing well. He's been doing great. It's a lot better than I expected this tournament in place of Montgomery. And he's a guy who's going to be a threat, and Tennessee's going to asterisk. Hayden Schott too. He has a run tonight, so he got on base. He actually got walked twice tonight. So he's gotten on base, and normally he's been hitting the ball at least multiple times a game as well. So it's not to the level of Tennessee's lineup, but it is one that can hang with it if their pitching helps them out in that regard. So I think it's kind of the opposite effect, and we'll get more into it. But Tennessee's pitching is kind of carried a little by its lineup, or it's helped a lot by its lineup. I think A&M's lineup has helped a lot by its pitching this year. It's kind of been flipped. So it's an interesting dynamic that we'll hopefully be looking forward to.
I don't know that you'll see two teams that coach hitting much better than the two teams that you're about to see in the finals. Again, if you catch us on the replay, we are assuming that A&M is going to hold on to a 5-0 lead in the eighth. Got 6 outs to go, and Jack Caglione just got a single, so there's that. But assuming they hold on, I don't know that there's two teams that coach hitting much better than these two programs. And, you know, to that, like Caden Sorrell Gavin Grohovac, both freshmen. They probably had the biggest hits of the night for A&M. So I'm amazed at their approach is so good year in and year out. They don't chase much out of the zone. They hammer it when you throw a strike. They will foul off pitches. Much in Tennessee's the same way. I mean, I feel like they are two teams that are very, very similarly put together. And I would have loved to have seen both teams fully healthy. And by the way, that includes Tennessee with an A.J. Russell. And we just kind of, you know, don't talk about him as an injured guy because he's been out so long. You've already kind of factored that. I mean, but think about those two's team. And look, I think it's going to be a great series anyway, but because just the way these teams match up. But think about if we could get both these teams at full health, what we would have seen in Omaha. But it's going to be, I think, pretty special even without that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an incredible series. And the main thing for A&M, I agree with you, they've been so good offensively since Lars Nagel's been there. I do kind of feel like it took them a little bit to get adjusted to the pitch clock. If you remember 2 years ago, like a Texas A&M game would be like 4 hours.
Yeah,
they would take their time in the box at the plate, do all that. So last year was kind of an adjustment period, not only for them but for everybody. But this year they have just really been so good and so consistent all season long, and they've been led by their offense. And here they are; they are what, just 6 outs away from playing for a national championship.
By the way, A&M's got Evan Oshin back up in the bullpen, so if it runs into trouble here. And look, you can probably use him in this spot tonight until Stewart, if Stewart gets in trouble, because you've got now presumably some rest, which is needed in this group too.
Yes. Yeah, I think you need it playing Tennessee. I'd say that. I think both teams would be in trouble if we got to that. That was kind of the concern, I think. Especially, I mean, we don't think this is going to happen, but can you imagine Florida's pitching scenario if they were somehow able to pull off two games?
Yeah.
What would they?
Well,
I would have no idea what to do.
I think all of the teams that, well, Florida's a little different. Florida's got a lot of guys that can go, and on a given night, they're really talented. You could get a really good performance or it could blow up. A&M's guys are more steady. Like, When Evan Oshenbeck comes out there, you know it's going to be quality almost every time. Right. Cortez is a little wonkier. It can be dominant some nights. It can be tonight when he goes 8 pitches and gets pulled after throwing 8 balls. And by the way, here comes Oshenbeck. You know, you've got Brad Rudess, who's been really good this year. I mean, I feel like Tennessee and A&M were equipped to be okay no matter what happened, even if one of them was playing tomorrow and the other team got some rest. I still feel like it would have been a competitive matchup. But again, you kind of want to see everybody's best baseball. In this version, if A&M gets out of this tonight and moves on without having to play another game, you get the pitching reset. I'm trying to think. They started Stamos in game one, right? And then went to Causey.
Yeah. They went that route. It was Stamos, then Causey, and then really they kind of went gone to Snead as a closer these past few games, because he did that again today and then did that against North Carolina. So his role kind of has switched a little. I wouldn't be shocked though if they do him either, in kind of the way they've been doing Causey. So it can be either way, but that's going to be the game one crew we have trotting out there for Tennessee.
And he'll be throwing those guys will be throwing on what 8 days rest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes a difference. Probably doesn't. It maybe get you off schedule just a little bit, but I think that's quibbling around the edges here. I hadn't thought of that till you said that about Snead. And look, he'd thrown what 71 innings coming into today. I wonder if that's a little bit of, hey, we've thrown this guy a lot of innings this year. Let's calm it down a little bit and see if we can get a little bit of that dominant edge back that he gave them early in the year.
Yeah, and it's worked a little bit. I mean, his save count now is up to 5. That might lead the team. It's tied with Aaron Combs, so that's up to 5 now.
Lead them in saves? That's what I would have guessed.
He has four. Yeah. He's second behind all of them. And then they have Marcus Phillips with three. That was Hoover when he did that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, you said, what was it, Chris? 70 heading into?
I think 71. I'll double check that.
Right. Because now I have memory. Right. Now I have 71 and two thirds. So, but either way, I mean, that's probably what they want to, because I think the batting average is at 250. So that tells me maybe it was a little higher than they would have liked the opposing batting average. They wanted to bring it down. And closing, I think, helps that a little bit. And you love him for his high fastball and that sort of stuff. And that's, I mean, that's what a closer normally has in his arsenal. So it's perfect. And I think, again, Tennessee's ability to learn as they've gone through this postseason has helped them so much. And it's helped them got to this point. And Snead's an example of that.
Yeah, he's only got a 19% strikeout rate coming in today. I feel like he's a better pitcher than that. He keeps the ball in the park. He's under 3% on home run rates. He is one of their leading ground ball guys. 25% of the plate appearances result in ground balls. Only guy higher than him is Kirby Cannell. So you got a lefty and a righty there who keep the ball on the ground, which is kind of handy in this day and age. But I mean, his whip had kind of gone up in recent weeks. Again, you know, Not as effective, but I think I hadn't really caught that, but I think that's a good point you make. And I think getting him, not that he couldn't give you one of those outings in the tournament at some point, because I always think he's capable, as good as that fastball is and as durable as he's been, but they might be better dialing it down with him a little bit in that spot like they did today. I hadn't considered that, but correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like peak Nate Snead this season would have been about maybe mid to late April. Alfred, does that sound about right?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah,
that sounds
I'd
right
have to
me.
Look
that,
it up, but yeah.
Right, because that was when mid to late April. I would think that was when they were starting to use him in bulk innings, and I think that's what you were talking about with the that's where we saw a lot of the dangerous stuff, and it wasn't necessarily like – I say bulk. It may not have even been that.
Well,
but it was multiple
bulk,
innings at least.
Sometimes bulk can be two or three. We're talking, they were letting him go five and six, and that's
lot. Right. And that's calmed down as of recent. And I think it gives them more options too, because they've also used Aaron Combs. I just said his save total. They go with Aaron Combs a good bit as well in a closing spot. So that bullpen, I think, looking back at it at the beginning of the year, there were questions about it, but as time's gone on, it's kind of reared its head up as one of the most dangerous ones we saw. And that's even before Tennessee made it to the championship series. I think people started saying that. So yeah. And that's just been adjustments made on the fly for them by Tony Vitale and Frank Anderson, who's arguably one of the best, if not the best pitching coach in the country. So it's been great stuff from that staff, and they continue to do it, and it's gotten them here, and they can throw, you know, Texas A&M is going to throw some heat at them with their own pitching, but they can do the same to the Aggie lineup if they want to. And I think that's where this great matchup kind of comes into play a lot.
Yeah, I'm going to give you ground ball rates for A&M staff coming into today, because this is going to be, I think, key with who the Aggies. And of course, Florida's doing this to me. Every time I write Florida off.
They make things interesting.
Yeah, Aschenbeck has just given up. What did Stewart give up the hit? He gave up a walk, which doesn't happen often. He's got a 4% free pass rate this year, guys. That's walks and hit by pitches. So Evan Aschenbeck basically never walks a guy, you know, once every 25 hitters, and he just did that. And is that Kurland? No, Kagler singled to lead off the inning. And they have just hit two rockets down third that both missed being fair by a few feet. Yeah,
barely.
So I think if I'm Schlossnagel, I'm not going to say I'm concerned. But
you
you've already gone through.
I said leaned up on the dugout wall a little more. Maybe.
Yeah, you've already gone through Cortez. You just went through Stewart. And look, you've got guys left. You got Rudish. You've got Isaac Morton, if you wanted to use him. You've got Brock Peary. You got Weston Moss. I guess a break glass in case of emergency Tanner Jones situation. And Zane Bodmaev, I think that's how you pronounce it, or maybe not. The Tarleton State kid. All right, we just got a harmless pop-up to right. Although Lavalette took an interesting route on that thing.
He sure did.
So now Gators men on the corners, but you'll definitely trade the advancement for an out here. Yeah.
Right. That might be it on my Tyler Shelnut bet. I said he was going to homer today.
The game's not over. So
that's true. Yeah, we'll see. Holding out hope for it.
There's another big out.
Oh, you're ahead of me, but I see it on the stat broadcast now. Mm-hmm. That is exactly what you wanted. Let's see where this thing was. I can't blame him for swinging at that. That was fastball right down the middle. He just missed. Well, I'm not going to say just missed it. He was a little late. Maybe he was expecting something off speed. And I mean, that's. Yeah, you don't see Ashabek leave you one like that often, but he did. And Sheldon couldn't do anything with it. So, guys, what else have we missed today? What else that was worth talking about that we haven't gotten to?
Kentucky went through a lot of pitchers today. I know they were down, but that was the most I've seen a team use in a while. If we wanted to just go back to that game, I guess just to say something about it. What is this? Eight? Yeah, they went eight guys. And looking at Florida, I mean, it was just kind of really the two innings where they exploded were the fifth and that first. And it was just, again, I think they were just dominant that game. And the other thing I'll say about Florida relating it back to this game, they got put in a tough spot. I mean, you guys, I think, could, you know, get behind that with playing a doubleheader and having to wait for an entire game in between to go back out there. It was just kind of the weather kind of messed them up a little bit today. Yeah. And I think that played a factor today because obviously I didn't expect them to score no runs this game. But who knows? Maybe that was A&M's pitching. We saw A&M do this to Kentucky, too. So it'll be interesting. I don't want to say that A&M would do this to Tennessee. In fact, I won't say that they'll do this to Tennessee, but it's the best pitching Tennessee has faced all year because these two teams met once in Hoover and that game was close and relatively low scoring. I believe it was like 5-3 or something like that. It was not a lot of runs. And yeah, I think Florida just kind of maybe ran out of gas with just all the outside factors they had today. So they spent a lot of energy also on that Kentucky game, which was maybe not what they want. Well, they wanted to do that, but maybe kind of hurt them here down the stretch.
That was the big thing for me. No matter who won Kentucky, Florida, you know, the obvious question is how much gas will either of those teams have left in the tank to take on Texas A&M? And again, you got to beat them not only once, but twice. That's a big strikeout there for A&M. The other thing I thought was interesting, like, I love tournament time where teams just do things totally different where they haven't done all season long. And today for Florida, Caglione, like, he was in the leadoff spot for both games today for the first time all season. Like, obviously, he's your best player. Just get him as many at-bats and plate appearances as possible. I thought that was a cool wrinkle that Florida did tonight, and it worked. I mean, he broke the program record in home runs throughout the course of the day.
I understand why more teams don't do that, but I'm a little surprised you don't see more teams hit. I mean, like, you're starting to see major, you know, hit a lot of times a guy will hit in a two spot.
Yeah.
It's your best hitter, which kind of makes sense because you get a few more at bats over the course of the season. And if you've got a leadoff guy who can get on, which at this day and age, college baseball, everybody's got a 450 on base guy somewhere. You slot that guy in front of your Condon or Caglione and have a go at it. But I'm a little surprised we don't see a little bit more of that because, I mean, you just get – I don't know how many more at-bats over the course of a college season your one hitter gets over your nine hitter, but it's probably, I don't know, 40?
Yeah, which makes a difference when you go back
– plate appearances? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's that was an interesting wrinkle. By the way, you were ahead of me on the strikeout. Aschenbeck threw a beauty of a breaking ball. It just caught the outside corner.
Yeah.
So maybe not a bad move because it looked like his fastball was getting hit.
So. Yeah. The other thing to, you know, we can touch on is what Florida State did in the Tennessee game. Just the pitching move, like no Jamie Arnold, like the broadcast, Ben McDonald, who I think is fantastic at what he does. Yeah. Like he kind of touched on it, read between the lines type thing. He brought it up. You know, it would have been 5 days rest for Jamie Arnold if he would have pitched today. But Ben McDonald said that's a conversation that you have with not only the pitcher, but his family and his agent.
Like, yes.
That was the big word to me. Like, obviously, he's going to be a high first-round draft pick. And if they all come to the decision, like, no, like, unless Florida State won game one, like, maybe we'll consider, you know, the next one. But without a doubt, no Jamie Arnold today, and they go with a true freshman, Abraham, who hadn't pitched in 17 days. So, and he only lasted a third of an inning.
Yeah, it was kind of –
go ahead, Alfred. I'm sorry.
I was just going to kind of just relate it back. Ooh, that's a hard hit on the wall. This is a triple for the Aggies, kind of not how you wanted to start that inning. But as I was saying – I think that's Ashton Wilson, is it not?
I believe so. He's hurting, looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a hard hit into that fence.
Did he hit one of the support beams?
He might have. I think that's a good – that he might have done that.
Yeah, we've had some – man, we've had some outfield injuries this tournament.
We have.
Inslee, him.
Well, and then – like
the wall's not existent. These guys
from tears today for Tennessee, like that was an insane catch, and he hammered the wall too.
Tough stuff.
We'll by the way, speaking of guys running into walls and making catches, the passing of Willie Mays, that was
sad day.
Yeah, maybe the best baseball player who ever lived. There's a few guys in that discussion, but I meant to mention that last night. Not that the Willie Mays family is listening, I'm sure, but our thoughts and prayers go out to them.
There was a lot of cool clips. I think my favorite clip that I saw was the old-timer games for the New York Mets when he was in center field. I think he was 52 years old. And he's still in the old timers game. He still made a ridiculous catch where he ran like 2 miles to make the catch in center field. Just a phenomenal athlete.
Well, he played well into his 40s.
Yeah.
Really, really good guy, too. I think everyone has kind of said that about him. I know a lot of away games, at least when he traveled, I think they said when he traveled anywhere for games. He would go into neighborhoods and play stickball with kids. Man. Like at a lot of places he would go. And that's what he would do during free time on the road. And so it's just a class act and wonderful man. And I didn't know this either. He was the oldest living member of the Hall of Fame, obviously up until his passing, but I didn't realize that he was the oldest one. So God bless him. And yeah, it's tough because it's just, even if you're not into baseball as much as I would say us three are at this point, you know that name and that kind of resonates. So sad.
Yeah, two of the
sad day.
Two of the greatest baseball players ever, both born in Alabama. He and Hank Aaron, who's from the Mobile area. So
he is. When I was in Mobile, working for the Mobile Bay Bears, Hank Aaron walked in one day. His childhood house is literally right next to the stadium. So there's not a team there anymore. So even if you still go to the ballpark, the house he grew up in, they turned it into a museum. It's like 10 feet away. But yeah, I was just at my desk one day and in walks Hank Aaron and I had to do like a triple take. Is that?
Yeah.
That's Hank Aaron.
What are they doing the game at Rickwood Field this summer? That's coming up soon, I feel like.
They just
know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, they just had a picture taken of was David Ortiz, A-Rod, a bunch of guys there. I think it's June 20th. I'll double check. So tomorrow. It could be tomorrow. I'll double check to make sure, but it's very soon. Yeah, June 20th. So that game's coming up, and that should be something. That's something I'm going to watch at least a little bit of. And I believe Florida just put in Jalen Guy.
Jalen Guy, yeah, who hasn't played in a minute.
Was he a midweeker?
How many injured outfielders from Florida now? Because Ty Evans went out, I think, the week before the tournament. They're missing somebody else, too. Who is
it? I'm trying to think.
I'll check the notes here. Hayden Yost, that's who it is.
Yes, yes, yes.
So Florida's down two starting outfielders. Jalen Guy was a transfer from Liberty who didn't really play much. At least hasn't in a while. I think his playing time was towards the first of the year. So,
Was he a midweek or two? A little bit, maybe?
Maybe.
Maybe. Not that their midweek was – the midweek was their downfall. So,
yeah.
But
I mean, speaking of teams with injuries, you give these guys Ty Evans. I mean, I don't know what would have made a difference. They got this far anyway. But Evans was on a tear about the time he got hurt. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, he's clearly their best hitter after Cagle. I mean, Colby Shelton could be that guy. He just wasn't consistent enough. He strikes out a little too much and just didn't, outside the home runs, didn't hit for, you know, as much average as you would have thought he would have. But I mean, that, you know, if you play this over a different year and Pierce Coppola gets healthy a little faster, there's a double that'll make it 6-0 or maybe a single. But that was ripped down first base.
A lot of camera time tonight for Jeff Kent.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. That was Grahovic,
that's a,
too,
that's
wasn't
a
it?
Guy that has got a kind of a, I think people just didn't like him, to be honest. It's not that baseball writers would be petty or things like that, but he's got a pretty good Hall of Fame case for second base. Of course, he also played in the, you know, towards the end of the steroid era. So there's kind of a cloud of suspicion over everybody. But I think the Brandon Neely expiration date may finally be here, Alfred.
Yeah, it's a tough spot too because he gave up. I guess Chris, I'm going to double check his home run numbers real quick, but it's I think there was after that home run. I think Kevin O'Sullivan was kind of like, okay. I mean, he's usually beyond that, has produced well enough for me this year. I'm going to stick with it, and then he just gave up another run just now. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put this as much on Florida's pitching tonight as much as they're batting. I mean, they just didn't get runs, and if you don't do that, you're not going to win the game. And I don't think we expected Coppola to necessarily just shove and give us, you know, a 7-inning runless start. But he put them in a position for most of that game to where they could easily take the lead. I mean, at the beginning, I think A&M's first two runs were on bases loaded walks to start this game. So, you know, he put them in a position to kind of be there. It just kind of it never happened for their lineup. And that was my worry initially. And we didn't see it when they played Kentucky today, but it was who beyond Caglione can get the hits for them at a consistent rate. We saw that a little this tournament from Ashton Wilson. But if you look tonight at what's kind of transpired here, Caglione with two hits, Kerlin has one, Shelton with one, but other guys in the lineup, Shelnut, Heyman, Ashton Wilson, I guess Jalen Guy just got in, so I can't really count him. But Dale Thomas, Dene, all over. So beyond Shelton, Kerlin, and Caglione, they didn't get hits. And that was kind of the problem. And they just didn't get enough on base. I look at their walks as well. Four walks for them tonight. So they just didn't get on base enough to really produce. And that's been their downfall. And
yeah, they finally pulled Neely. For Luke McNeely, after he threw his 45th pitch, was about the best one he threw all night. Maybe it was a 94 four seamer that held the plane and was about letter high for Travis Chestnut, who just swung through it. Chestnut, by the way, that's another really good player that they have who probably gets a little playing time with the Montgomery injury, but he's been super productive. But he's got a .455 on base and he's got a 21% walk rate. So
again, he stole 17 bases too. He's fast.
Yeah.
He's definitely one of their steal threats. So he's a big time. He's a name also I'd circle if I'm Tony Vitello going into this weekend. And one, I think when you have Montgomery out there, really even right now, I don't think he's the first name you kind of go to in that lineup when you talk about what he could do, but I would say pretty underrated comparing him to the way people talk about these other A&M batters.
Hey, how's Jason LaViolette moved around tonight? Because I caught the back half of this game and not the front half just because of family stuff. But they played him in right, which I think was a good sign. I thought, well, if he plays, he's probably going to DH. So they didn't have him center. It's a little less taxi. But the fact that hammy was good enough to play in right, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a little bit of an upset to me.
Well, during the second game, like, they even cut to him. Like, he was in the batting cage, and I think it was Coral Ravage. He said, like, the plan is he's going to DH tonight, and here he is. He gets to start in right field. So, I mean, he's looked pretty good to me out there. Like, you can't really tell that it's had a negative impact on him.
Poor Brandon Neely in tears in the dugout.
Yeah, very emotional.
Probably his last college game. He's probably a top five round guy. I consult MLB Pipeline a lot. They have a good free service, and it's run by the MLB Scouting Bureau. So I lean on there a lot. I'm not going to say they're perfect, but you would figure they've got a pretty good inside track on things. I think I want to say he might not have been in their top 200 a couple of weeks ago, and he snuck in there in the last couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think he'll be a junior with leverage. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I think that's the case. So,
but nowadays, like, you never know if Florida comes back to him, puts together an NIL package. Yeah. Just, it's a whole new age.
That's true. The definition of leverage has absolutely changed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially in the Major League Baseball draft, because used to, if you were a senior that had zero leverage, they were going to sign you for pennies and a hot dog.
Yeah.
Brandon Neely.
He's feeling it.
I was about to say, everyone should tip his, no matter who you're a fan of watching this, you should tip your hat to that guy. Cause I haven't seen, at least in my short time compared to YouTube watching college baseball, I haven't seen a tournament, or I can't really even think of, like, strung together pitching performances like that out of anybody. I mean,
I've never seen it.
Yeah. So I tip my hat to him. He played his tail off this tournament, but I would love to see. I mean, if he could come back and they could do a little NIL package, Florida's pitching staff, I mean, they have boatloads of freshmen that kind of need an off season. So that'll be something special if they could somehow make that work, but to be decided in the future.
I would presume they'll be a preseason top five team, even without Caglione, just because some of those arms can come back and they pitch so well late. But, you know, this is the NIL era and the portal era. So the loyalty to teams isn't what it used to be, but a guy that's bawling his eyes out in the dugout afterwards, cause he didn't get the job done, air quotes, cause we know what he was up against. But yeah, that's a guy that not only just gave them everything in terms of the pitch counts, but man, this guy, started, he was a closer, then he was a starter, then went back to closer. They had some real pitching struggles, and that's a guy, as a coach, you just love, who says, hey, whatever you need from me, I'll go do it. And nobody did that more than him this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They, and just kind of a little side note on them, the big transfer portal signing they've had so far, I forgot his name, but I got it here. Blake Sear. It's spelled C-Y-R. Yeah, I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. Sear, thank you. Utility player. big time hitter because they're going to lose obviously big hitters in Caglione and whatnot. Really good hitter, 284 average, 397 on base. I'm looking at what else. I think he had 17 home runs, 63 RBIs, and he was all ACC accolades this year at Miami. So
yeah,
that's one name at least they've gotten, and they'll get more because if you're Florida baseball, you have some pull. I'm sure you two, you know, could get behind me on that.
Well, Kevin O'Sullivan's always had a top five recruiting class.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And so they've gone portal heavy the last couple of years. They got Shelton from Alabama, Ashton Wilson from Charleston Southern. Brody Donay was a Virginia Tech kid. I think they thought he would have maybe a little better here than he did, although he really came on late. He and Heyman kind of split the catching duties. And Donay, I think, was DH'ing a little more late in the year, if I've got that right. They got guy was from Liberty, didn't play much. The pitching was all homegrown Florida. And again, really high school heavy this year. But last year they had the catcher, BT Riopelle. He was from Coastal Carolina. So they've hit the portal with some success to fill some holes recently.
Yeah. You got to have balance. Like, you can't just lean on portal guys. Like, you got to have some sort of culture, team chemistry, homegrown talent with a nice mix of the transfer portal. That goes for any sport, but especially for baseball. It's most amount of games played. It's a long season. When you go on the road, that's where you bond with everybody. You spend the most time with everybody. So it's very important to have a good mix for sure.
And they also landed Hurston Waldrop from Southern Miss last year, who was one of their weekend guys and pitched well in the postseason. In fact, they've got three guys. I knew I was forgetting somebody. You've already had three guys make the big leagues, I think, from that last year. You've had Langford, you've had Waldrop, and you've had Skeens. And like I said last night, Cruz just got promoted to AAA this week. So that could be four who could be up by the end of the year.
I feel like that's changed a little bit too. Like, if you're a high pick, like top 10 to 15, they are not shy about fast-tracking you nowadays. No. I mean, look at what we saw with Jackson Holliday. I mean, he torpedoed to the major leagues and went 2 for 22, whatever he did, and got sent back down. But used to, like, it was patience. We'll take our time, and when you're ready, you're ready. And that is not the case so much anymore with the high, like, 10 to top 15 picks.
Well, and usually when you see a guy fast-tracked recently, it's been like a Ben Joyce who was, you know, throwing 115 out of the pen for Tennessee. That's sarcastic, but not by obviously. I think he was 104 legit, maybe 105. It's those kind of guys. Going back a few years.
Jordan Beck's playing for the Rockies now and doing pretty well. So he's kind of fast, maybe a little less fast-tracked, but he kind of made his way quick.
Troy Lipscomb's been up with the Nationals up and down a couple of times. I'm thinking 10 years ago, there was a guy for TCU. Didn't have any staying power, but he hit it. I felt like he went from the College World Series to maybe pitching in somebody's pen by the end of the year. Or maybe it was early next year. If you said the name, I would know it. And I'll tell you who else did that was Chase Silseth, who started his career at Tennessee, went to Arizona, and was pitching for the Angels, I think, last year. So,
yeah. And you mentioned Skeens. Like, what he's been able to do is just insane to me. Like, he makes it look so easy. Yeah. And that is, like, it is not that easy what he's been able to do this quickly.
They started picking apart the shape of his fastballs, like, are we getting a little too in the weeds here? Because I watched him pitch, and I know what I saw. Nobody could hit him. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I think that's sometimes what happens when you just got – it's like watching NFL draft, right? And you got to – you know, we got this generational quarterback coming, and then we got nothing to talk about in February and March. And so, like
– it's picked apart. Yeah,
for endless – and I feel like that kind of happened with Skeens a little bit. But you can ask Shohei Ohtani about that.
Yeah. Think about it. Like Skeens was in this tournament a year ago.
I know.
He already has like 5 starts underneath his belt at the big league level.
All right, it's official. A&M has knocked out Florida 6-0. The win will go to Justin Lampkin. And I think, I mean, when we start up Saturday, I would expect it to be Chris Stamos / AJ Causey. Again, Alfred, you and I talked about this. We talked about it before the Florida State game. I think at some point you might just go Causey out the gate because it's not gone well for Stamos lately. Now look, if they got, you know, 4 lefties in the top 4 spots or something, then maybe rethink it. But I don't know. Causey's your effectively your starter anyway.
Right.
Maybe you just go with it. A&M, I think, would
Prager. Wait, right?
Yeah, but gosh, there's been so many games around. Am I dreaming, or did Prager start game 2
against Kentucky? That was the game he started.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was game 2. They did something weird game 1, didn't they? I've got the box scores around here somewhere.
I was gonna say, I'll while you do that, I'll talk about Stamos real quick. I told you, it's kind of phasing out a little for me. The last time that really was effective to me, I think this was Hoover when they played A&M. So this is good for comparative sake. He did go 3 1/3 with 3 strikeouts that game. I mean, he only gave up a hit. It looks like, yeah, only gave up 1 hit there. That was good. But the starts since then were Northern Kentucky in the regional, Evansville in the super, and then Florida State to start the tournament. And Northern Kentucky was 1/3 of an inning. Evansville was 1 1/3, and Florida State was 1/3. I think I get the idea of an opener, but at the same time, it's kind of like, I don't know why you would just not let Causey get in rhythm right off the rip. And if you want to use Stamos, that's fine, but you can use him as a middle inning guy and let him go jumbo if he can do it, or just get him to go in there in a high leverage situation and feel confident in him and with that, and let him kind of work his way out of it. So I feel like Stamos is good in his own right, but he's in weird situations where, you know, Tony Vitale and the crew kind of want to do stuff different with them. And until Valhalla is telling me Causey just prefers to come out of the pen for whatever reason. I mean, yeah, it's just kind of, it's weird. I feel like it hurts Stamos a little bit too, just because he doesn't get enough time on the mound to get a fair estimate of what he's about.
Okay, Lampkin started that first game. I'd forgotten that. And in my defense, I was on the road, but he went 42 pitches over 3 innings. So they bring him back tonight. He throws 70 over 5 innings. So yeah, they got 2 really good starts out of Justin Lampkin. I mean, if you consider 3 innings a start. Mm-hmm. So now if you're A&M, you've got Prager's worst start this year got followed by Jim the other night against Kentucky, where they didn't give up a hit until the 7th. You got Lampkin throwing better. Yeah, I mean, and you've got a bullpen. I don't know if the way Cortez threw tonight is a concern, or it's just a that's baseball that happened tonight. But you don't expect him to throw 8 pitches and all be balls and get yanked. But
right.
Point being, and I do wonder Aschenbeck too, the way they, and again, it didn't go on the box score because they didn't go for hits, but there were some hard hit foul balls off him and didn't miss by much. Like circling back to Tennessee with your point about Snead throwing shorter outings, you do wonder at some point, are some of these guys running up against a little bit of a wall? And you will see this happen a lot of times in the postseason. You saw it happen with Kevin Copps at Arkansas, where they just threw him and threw him and threw him. Well, hey, it's working, guys. Let's keep going with what's working. And finally, he runs in a wall. We saw it with Neely.
Yeah.
Now, those were a little different, right? Aschenbeck's not throwing 50 pitches every day like Brandon Neely was and like Copps was. But innings count on those guys at this point. Cortez 16 1/3 coming into tonight. and it'll stay 60 and a third since he didn't get out. And Oshimek 68. I don't think I've ever seen a team that's thrown two relievers over 60 innings in the same season. That's insane. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying those guys are gas. I'm not, I just don't know, but I do know that Oshenbeck gave up a walk first hitter he faces, which is a rarity, and then gave up hard hit foul balls to the next two guys. So I don't know, probably nothing, but just a little something I'm wondering about.
Yeah, it's kind of weird too. I keep forgetting. I forgot just now. Not forgot, but it just occurred to me. I'm looking at D1 for A&M. Not having Sedeo in there kind of makes their starting pitching a little, like, evaluating what you're going to do with it. I think it makes it a little more, I guess, dicey than it normally would be for them, especially over, you know, a best 2 of 3 at this point. So I don't know. And I kept thinking that Kentucky game was a while ago. It would be 4 days rest for Prager on 90 plus pitches, which is, I think you guys are a better judge of it. That's borderline. You know what I mean? Borderline enough rest.
I think you do it. I mean, it's for the national
championship.
I mean, yeah, you're just going to do things that you normally don't do.
Right.
Everybody stretches everything in Omaha. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I would imagine they just do him game one, and I say just do him. He's the best pitcher we have left between the two teams. So it'll be suitable, but I think that's the matchup we get, I guess, heading to this one, and we'll get more into it too when we do a preview about it.
Well, look, if you get Lampkin, because they'll go, I would think they'll go Prager in the opener on Saturday, and I would presume they'd go back to Lampkin on Sunday. So this is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's a little questionable. But I don't know. You've seen crazier stuff. Alfred, I'm going to give you a homework assignment for tomorrow, because we'll do our official preview and then we'll dive into this. I want to see what Tennessee's splits were against lefties. I'm guessing there wasn't a huge difference, because, you know, it's like the Dr. Seuss book. You know, they hit, you know, can hit with the, you know, with the cat, you know,
and the bats,
and a hat, and yeah, I mean, anywhere, anytime. I mean, if there was something that gave Tennessee a lot of trouble, then it wasn't readily evident. But I don't know. Prager's a lefty. Lampkin's a lefty. Oshenbeck, their best reliever, is a lefty. So if there's something there, I mean, A&M would do that anyway, right? You're going to throw those guys out there. But I'm just kind of curious to see if there's any difference in there anywhere. And we'll look that up for tomorrow. And as for Tennessee, I mean, if you go effectively Causey, Beam, Sechrist, you're right-handed heavy. And A&M is, again, and both these lineups are pretty balanced. You got Appel, Burton, Grahovac, Camarillo, Chestnut are your righties. So it's five righties, four lefties, presuming they go Appel, Burton, Kent, Grahovac, Camarillo, Sorrell, Chestnut, Laviolette, and Schott. That's been their normal lineup with Montgomery out.
I'm trying to think. I'll look into that. The other interesting thing, too, I guess Tennessee's pitching too. Their splits against righty and lefty batters, because I know with certain guys they have, like Cannell is good against lefties because that's the same hand, but righties is kind of what brings his level down, you know, a little bit when he faces them, because he gets all his fame, of course, from the lefties he faces. So I guess on the other side of that, that's the handiness, I think, is going to be very key, especially, you know, with A&M. With Prager's start coming, we don't know if it'll get extended because he went 90 pitches, so they could let him go 50 to 60, you know, depending on how they feel with it, and then send in their bullpen guys to relieve and do a lot of that work. So it may get switched up, and Tennessee's going to do the same thing too, obviously, with Causey, you know, because he's just not your traditional starter. So We'd have to. Yeah, it's a lot of that's going to come into play as we look more into it.
Well, and somebody brought this up in the chat. I did think it may just be one of those weird deals where a kid just feels more comfortable coming out of the pen for whatever reason.
Right.
Maybe just seeing a couple of batters. I don't know. I mean, it's worked for them all year.
Yeah.
Even if it hasn't been pretty, you know, for the first few batters the last time. I mean, Tennessee's got enough offense. You've got a little built-in grace there if something goes wrong, because Tennessee could put 12 up on you in a hurry. But this is going to be, I think this will be the best pitching staff Tennessee has faced all year. And look, you can maybe say the same thing for A&M. A&M this year missed Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri in conference play. Tennessee missed A&M, Arkansas, Mississippi State. Which actually might be the best three pitching staffs not named Tennessee. So there was that.
Yeah.
I mean, A&M did get Hagan Smith at some point. So I guess they saw that already. But beyond that, I mean, I really think as of late and into postseason play, it's the best that they've seen to date. And obviously, as Josh Carter saying in the chat, they did play in Hoover. I mentioned that earlier. And that game was tight-knit and close and relatively low scoring as far as Tennessee's batting goes. So it'll be interesting to see what they do, because these teams have obviously evolved since then by playing the entire tournament. And I mean, I think it's the best possible matchup we could have gotten.
Tennessee lost one 3-game series all year. See if you guys remember who it was.
Alabama.
Yep. Good call.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah.
Was that the first weekend series of the year?
The first SEC one. First
SEC weekend series. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember Bama smoked the cigars and everything.
And A&M lost. At one point, I had A&M number one in the power rankings, and then they kind of hit a lull late in the year.
They did.
They lost that series at LSU and at Ole Miss. And they're like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And then, and I think took the series from Arkansas, correct?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. God, that seems forever ago now, doesn't it?
It does.
Yes, it's been a while ago. Long time since then.
When the season started, it was, you know, we're playing in 30-degree temperatures, and now we're hotter than we can stand.
No, I know. You were doing SEC basketball regular season stuff, it felt like, still along with it. I remember that.
This season wore me out. I did not get into baseball fully until about late March, just because I had so much on my plate with hoops, which is rare for me. But Well, I got help here that I didn't have at the start of the year. Well, I had Alfred. I just didn't have time to use him. So, it's good. Products going to look much different going forward for SEC baseball if you've been around. And by the way, we got some stuff we're not going to let out yet, but we're kind of excited about. You guys are about to have a big homework assignment. I think you know that.
Mm-hmm.
With the draft coming up.
I mean,
you get a break, and then we go right in. What's the draft date? It's in July.
Let me see.
We get a little break.
It's pretty late. I feel like they keep pushing it back later and later.
You know, they had the right idea, and then COVID killed this like it killed a lot of.
It's July 14th through the 16th.
I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I'm glad to have a little bit of a break. But the best idea they ever had was putting that thing in Omaha. And I think the year they had COVID, I think, were they not going to do it right before play started, like a day or two before? What was the plan there, Graham? I don't remember now.
I feel like the last 3 to 4 years, they just change it and they don't stick to anything. Like, it all just kind of blends in. But I didn't, like, you remember, it felt like forever that the draft was like 50 rounds.
It used to be unlimited. Yeah. It used to be until you just got sick of picking. Like,
yeah,
Mike Piazza was famously a 66th rounder, I think, but I think some teams just threw up the white flag before then. And
yeah, exactly.
The Dodgers said, all right, your Tommy Lasorda's godson, will throw you a courtesy pick. And it worked out pretty well. But I'm thinking about doing it. Maybe a first round draft live stream.
Yeah.
Get our prep done, know who all the commits are. And of course, you got a lot of SEC players in this thing. I mean, you're going to see a lot of guys, Condon, Caglione, Christian Moore, maybe Billy Amick, Hagan Smith. I'm sure I'm Braden Montgomery. That's just off the top of my head. I'm sure I'm missing somebody. You're going to see a lot of SEC guys.
Tons of them.
First round.
I've seen a lot of people like Dakota Jordan, too. He's been another name.
Yeah, he's first rounder.
Yeah, so just a lot of names up there.
Angelo Sancha will be in there now, I think, after the way he pitched late. I don't know if Cal Steven will make it that high, but he'll go top three or four rounds, I think.
Right.
And then you always got some team that you know, likes a guy that, you know, everybody's got in the 60s or 70s and throws a late first round. Well, that's usually somebody looking to save money, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think, we've gone an hour and 15 minutes. Again, if you're joining us late, we've talked about just about everything. We spent more of the first part of the broadcast talking about Tennessee and what it did today. We spent the latter part talking more about A&M because that was going on as we were doing this live, if you're catching it later. So we gave a little bit of homage to Matt LaPorta and Jack Caglione. Here's one more thing. We spent a little time on Kentucky, and this is a little repetitive, but let's give props to Nick Mangione, because he was our coach of the year. I feel like, and you look at their pitching, and I wondered at some point, would it run out a little bit? Because they weren't dominant arms. And I feel like the way you beat a Tennessee or an A&M or some of these really elite teams is if you let them put the ball in play, you might pay for it. And certainly Kentucky paid for that today against Florida. I mean, Poozer, Niemann, and Moore all had strikeout rates of 20%, which is nothing special this day and age of college baseball. And, I mean, and some of their bullpen guys, O'Brien had a pretty nice strikeout rate. Hummel did, but his effectiveness was off and on. I feel like him finding a countercultural way to win in this day and age with Waldschmidt, with Nicholson, with all those guys, that was the beef of their order, but the running with Petre and Burks and all those guys, and they just were so consistent this year and last year. I'm very happy for Nick Mangione. I think he's one of the good guys in our league, and it didn't end well for the Finn today, and so we spent a lot of focus on Florida and giving the Gators props for what they did early this morning. But hats off to Kentucky on a phenomenal year.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I think they're on the right track. I mean, they got their first Omaha win ever. That in and of itself is something that team can be very proud of. Graham, you said this too. Just throughout Omaha, they're older. They're an older team. So I think it's going to be a team that's going to go through a lot of changes heading into next year, but they couldn't have a better guy at the helm. I think Nick Mangione is an incredible personality. I mean, I sat on his press conferences in Hoover, and he's upbeat, likable. You know, you could do anything bad you wanted in front of him, and he's still going to have a smile on his face. So Kentucky's in a good spot with baseball for the time being. And I feel like that school, Chris, you and I talked about it throughout the year. They've kind of grown a good liking for baseball. You know, we all know basketball is king there and whatnot, but they've grown a very good liking for baseball as Tennessee has kind of grown into over the course of the past 5 years, at least in the Vitello era, and it mirrors that a little bit. So he's got them on the right track, and they should be nothing but pleased with where they're at as a program and with their season.
it was kind of like a just a slow but steady build for him. You know, they did have a couple of years that I'm sure, you know, he didn't envision. And then last year, go to the Super Regionals and able to build off that this year and go to Omaha for the first time. I had their series this year at Auburn. Got to visit with them before the three-game series. You know, we interviewed him a couple times live on the air. Like, I am a fan. Like, I was blown away. He is as genuine as it gets. He was phenomenal to talk and visit with. And that was a fun series to do. My broadcast partner for one of the games was John Cohen, actually.
Interesting.
So John Cohen obviously ties to both programs. He was the head coach at Kentucky for 5 years, and now is the athletic director at Auburn. So, and both of those head coaches, Butch and Mingio, they were both under Cohen as assistant coaches at Mississippi State. So it was kind of like a homecoming of sorts that particular weekend. But phenomenal human being and just really happy for him and all the success that Kentucky had this year.
Guys, you know what we're going to have now, and this is the first time we've talked about it. You're going to have a fifth different national champion over the last five College World Series and a first-timer, whoever wins it.
Yeah.
So just, it'll be working backwards. It'll be – let's see, either Tennessee or A&M this year, last year LSU, year before Ole Miss, year before Mississippi State, year before that got scratched. I think it would have been an SEC team, might have been Vandy, might have been Tennessee, might have been Georgia. Wouldn't that have been fun if it had been Georgia, given the train of conversation? Mm-hmm. And then 2019 was Vandy, and 2018 at Arkansas, and forgive me, Arkansas fans, if you're listening, you're probably not. But if not for a drop pop-up, it would have been Arkansas. And that would have been let's just play this for fun, okay? Let's say Georgia, which had probably the best team Georgia's ever had Emerson. And that's when Georgia had really some pitching. Let's give Georgia 2020 just for fun. Or you could give it to Tennessee in 2020 just for fun and say A&M wins this year. You could have had a scenario with the season in one break where you had, what, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 20. You could have had seven different SEC champs in 7 years. No, wait, eight, because Florida won it in 17, right?
Yes.
Correct, yeah.
That's crazy.
That would be.
And again, all that's is if you have a season in 2020 – and say either Georgia or Tennessee wins it, and if Tennessee wins it, A&M wins it this year. But that's a lot of ifs, but we're here to do ifs and have some fun. And if Arkansas catches a pop-up.
Shows how tough this league is.
Well, and also you had Kentucky is one of the top four teams standing this year, not in that discussion. And who else are we missing? Auburn's been to the College World Series in that span. Alabama hasn't, but was in a super regional last year. Mm-hmm. You had who else are we missing? Oklahoma now joins the SEC in the title series 2 years ago. Texas joins the SEC next year. Texas was 0-4 the last time Texas won it.
Yeah, they beat Ole Miss and Oxford in the super regionals. First super regional that Ole Miss ever hosted.
Okay,
that's the one. Augie after Texas won the whole thing. Like that's the one where Augie said, "You know, we won the national championship the day that they won the super regional at Ole Miss."
Yeah. Which Ole Miss team was that?
Stephen Head, Coughlin, Petway, that group of guys. That was one of the first early Mike Bianco, Dan McDonald, Ole Miss built teams.
Okay, that was a Stephen Head two-way year, right? I think his whole career was that, wasn't it?
For the most part, yeah. It was kind of like his breakout game was against South Carolina. I'm pretty sure it was at Columbia, and he threw like a one or two hit complete game, and it was like, okay, he needs to pitch more, and then turn into a phenomenal two-way player.
He never made the bigs, I don't think, did he?
He came close. He came AAA, and when he retired from playing, came back on staff, was at Ole Miss, and he's been a scout for the Dodgers organization for a little bit here now, which is a good organization to be a scout for.
Oh, yeah, it is, especially we got the resources they've got. But, all right, let's circle back to that conversation a minute ago. All right, who do we miss on the bingo card? We miss South Carolina, which Rich was back-to-back and one game from going back-to-back-to-back. What was that? Was that 2012?
The year that was when Arizona beat them.
It was. Yeah. Yeah. They won 2010-2011. Beat Florida in the finals one of those years. I don't remember who they beat in the finals, the other one. And again, all came within one game. I mean, and Missouri's the other team we didn't mention on that list. And Missouri was actually pretty good in baseball until the SEC kind of broke it. That's when Missouri, if you didn't know, Missouri produced Max Scherzer and Aaron Crow. And Crow was actually probably the better college pitcher. But they were really good in the Big 12. But this league either makes you stronger or it breaks you, and it broke Missouri because they hadn't been to a tournament since. Although I would argue probably deserved a couple that the committee didn't give it. But anyway, they paid Ole Miss back with the favor in 2022, I guess. We won't open that can of worms, will we, Graham?
Not tonight.
All right, let's get some sleep. We will probably come out with the preview sometime tomorrow of Tennessee and A&M. It will not be live. It will be researched and in-depth, and we'll do maybe a little more digging on splits. Although I don't know how much – these teams are so balanced with their lineups, mm-hmm. with the lefty-righty splits. There's not a – you know, it's not one of these teams who got one lefty and eight righties. So I don't know how much it matters. But we'll look into it. We'll be doing live streams, I think, after every game, family situations permitting. Mine's really fluid right now, with some stuff I'm having to go through with my parents, but, God willing, and even if not, I may just turn the keys over to you guys and let you deal with it. But, any way you slice it, we'll be back for more of this. Thank you for all you listening and watching on the live stream tonight. Again, if you're catching this late, you can catch it on the site later in its entirety. For Graham Doty, for Alfred Esmond, I'm Chris Lee. We're Southeastern 14. Thanks for watching. We'll see you again soon.